Can you give me your biographical information, such as name, date of birth, place of birth?
My name is Masaichi Katayama. I was born July 17, 1922, in Long Beach, California.
Yeah. Tell me more about your family background.
Okay, my father and mother are both from Japan. They're both from a city called Okayama.
Okayama.
Yes, uh-huh. My father came over in the winter of 1905. And my mother came over as a picture bride in 1919. My father was a truck farmer and farmed in California.
In Long Beach area?
In Long Beach area. And we moved from the Long Beach area when I was about 2.5 years of age, and settled in Indiana. And so he farmed in the territory close to the town of North Judson, Indiana.
Which is located in what part of Indiana?
It's about the north central, north of Indianapolis, but not real far north, but north central.
When was it?
When I was 2.5, that would be about 25, 26, someplace in there, 26 probably,
mm-hmm.
or 25 probably, because I wasn't quite 3 years old when we moved,
mm-hmm.
and we moved in the spring. Mm-hmm. So I started the first grade and part of my second grade there in North Judson, and then we moved for 1 year into the farm again in Lowell, Indiana. And after being there a year, we moved to Northern Illinois, and I did most of my grade school and all of my high school in Northern Illinois.
Where did you go to school or college?
I went to McKendree College in Lebanon, Illinois, which is a United Methodist, small United Methodist school. Just outside of East St. Louis. And while I was in college, I served a student church in East St. Louis, mm-hmm. Illinois. It's called Lessie Bates Davis Neighborhood House, which was a settlement house really run by what was then the Women's Society of Christian Service.
Mm-hmm.
So after graduating, I was out of high school 7 years before I started college, and probably wouldn't have started college except I felt the call to enter the ministry, and so I was 24 when I started college, and went through very quickly in 3 years, and then went to Drew.
When you graduated from McKendree?
I graduated from McKendree in 1949,
uh-huh.
and then started Drew and graduated from Drew in 1952,
uh-huh.
and after graduating from Drew, I came to the South Indiana Conference, and I've been here
ever since.
Yes.
When did you get ordained?
I was ordained in as a deacon in 1953. I graduated in 52, but because I was coming to a different conference, they asked me to, and nobody knew me in this conference, they asked me to serve as a local pastor for 1 year. So I was ordained a deacon in 1953 and ordained an elder in 1955.
Where is your first assignment?
My first assignment was just a couple of miles from here, a two-point rural charge called Marietta and Bengal.
Mm-hmm.
Bengal no longer has a church, it's closed, but mm-hmm. I was there for 5 years and then went into the inner city of Indianapolis and served a church and was the executive director of a community center for 5 years. After that, I became an associate with Leroy Hodak, who is now the bishop of this area, and was his associate at Bloomington First Church. Went to a county seat town of Lawrenceburg for 6 years. Served 2 years at a church called Michigan Street, along with attempting to start a campus ministry at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And after 2 years, I decided that they really needed a full-time person in that job, so they did bring a full-time person in. I went to a church in the suburbs of Indianapolis called New Palestine. I was there 6 years, and then, or 7 years. And then the last 6 years, I served as district superintendent of the Indianapolis Southeast District. Mm-hmm. And retired from that job.
Mm-hmm. Last year you retired?
I just retired in June.
This year?
This year.
1987?
Yes, right.
So altogether, how many years you spent?
I have 30, yeah, I have 35 years, I think, in the South Indiana Conference.
35 years.
Yes.
Okay, so much for the general information. So, all these years you served the Anglo Church only?
Only have served an Anglo Church, mm-hmm. Yes. The only Asian church we have is a Korean church, and it started long after I came into this conference.
Okay, while you are in the ministry, any particular problems you experience, such as maybe discrimination or racism, whatever?
Yeah.
Okay, tell me something about that.
Well, the biggest discrimination that came to me was before I ever got into the South Indiana Conference. And that was after my first year of seminary. I was eligible at that time. You only needed 1 year of seminary. And after my first year of seminary, I was eligible to become a probationary member of the Southern Illinois Conference, out of which I came. But the Southern Illinois Conference board would not recommend me for membership because they felt that under the guaranteed appointment thing, they might not always be able to appoint me. Mm-hmm. And so they would not let me in. And so I went my whole middle year and the first semester, my senior year in seminary, really not knowing where I was going to go or anything else. But and luckily, at that time, conferences were looking for people. Mm-hmm. And Bishop Raines, who was then the bishop of this area, came out to Drew, and I talked to him, and they extended me the invitation to come here to the South Indiana Conference. So I've been here ever since.
So whenever you are appointed, maybe an initial reaction from your congregation is somewhat negative? Or?
Well, no, I don't think. I think there was some negative feeling before I came. I've never heard anything directly, but some friends have told me that one of the churches said they're going to appoint an Oriental now, next they're going to send us a black, sort of idea. But I would say that after I've gotten to a church, I've had very little discrimination. I think maybe I've had more difficulty being single, mm-hmm. because I'm a bachelor, mm-hmm. than because I'm Oriental. I didn't feel that there was much discrimination. Well, one thing is, you know, I'm the only Oriental minister in this whole conference, except for the few that are serving, the one who's serving a Korean church now. Right now we have a fellow from Guam, you know, but nobody thinks of him as being Asian at all. So maybe that's one of the reasons. If there were more of us, we might have, you know, there might have been more. But seeing I was the only one when I came in, and for years was the only Oriental in this conference.
Your brothers are served in Simpson Church, is that correct?
Yes, my brother was at Simpson. He's with the General Board of Mission, Global Ministries. He's been there for the last 7 years or so.
Younger brother?
Yes, a younger brother.
So he's the one who served the Simpson Church.
He was at Simpson, right.
So I'm confused.
Okay. That was my brother started in Indiana. Right. He was and he was serving a student church in the North Conference already, because he went to Garrett and was just serving in the student church. And so he stayed up there and served up in the North Conference for many years before he went out to the Rocky Mountain Conference and mm-hmm. served, I think, out there 4 or 5 years, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. at Simpson.
How come you use the Japanese name, first name especially. I was amazed when you were born in this country.
Yes, I don't have any other name. People call me Mike, but Mike is not my name. It was a name that was just given to me years and years ago. Uh-huh. The only names I have, Masaichi is the only name I have.
Yeah, that's a typical Japanese name.
Yes, yes, yes. But it's the only name I have.
Usually Issei has that usually right. Given names American names.
Yes. Now my brother's name is Roy, you know, which is an Anglo name, but he has no Japanese name. So he's just Roy.
So the your parents are named that way, huh?
Yes, I think what my mother said was that I think my brother's doctor's name was Roy, and so they named him Roy. But my I have a sister who is Michiko. And
that's a typical Japanese
name.
Yes,
right. And she has no other name. So neither one of us have an Anglo name at all, officially.
I see. So that's a rather unusual.
Yes, it is unusual.
Have you run into any Japanese like you in terms of name? The second generation.
No,
Japanese.
Most of them have an English name and a Japanese name. Okay. Yes. Yes.
But you are exception, I guess.
Yes, I don't have any.
I thought that you had an Issei because.
No, I'm an Issei.
What is the highlight of your career? You are now retired. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me some of accomplishments you think you made during the 35 years yes. ministry? So. High point, low point, so that you know who you are, what you are.
Well, I don't know of any, spectacular accomplishments at all. I think that when I went to Fletcher Place, which is a church in a community center, is a very small church, but a huge community center program. I think I was the first person they sent there from our conference. They'd always brought somebody in from outside to do it. I had no real knowledge about inner city because I grew up on a farm all my life. And I think that I think I was fairly instrumental in bringing that program out from merely a care type of thing to a program which gave youngsters some concept of citizenship and everything else that went with it. And brought the community center from strictly a recreational type of thing to the understanding of how to work together in small groups and things of that sort. So I think I'm really happy with what happened at that point at the community center. And I think more so because I went in there without knowing anything about how to proceed and having picked it up by reading, going to meetings, continuing education, this sort of thing. And until I think I got so I understood it fairly well. You never understand it well, but understand it fairly well. I think really when I say what did I enjoy the most, I was at in Bloomington as an associate in the early 60s, in the middle 60s. At First Church. And those were to me were really exciting years to be on a college campus like Indiana University during those early 60s.
Do you associate with the Japanese students?
Some. Though there weren't a whole lot there. But yes, I had an apartment in the Wesley Foundation building. They used to come over quite often. And so, yes, I did at that time. Mm-hmm.
The Japanese students and as well as American students. So.
Yes, But it was a time of real unrest, and everything else in the college campus. And they were difficult times, but it was still an exciting time to be there.
So how many years have you served there?
I was there 4 years.
4 years?
Yes.
Mostly dealing with the students?
No, I really wasn't. I dealt a lot with the students because you had to, because
college time.
Two-thirds of more than two-thirds of our congregation were college students at that time. But we had a campus worker who had a direct connection with students. But I was on campus quite often, teaching classes, meeting with groups in dormitories or in sorority and fraternity houses and things like that. So.
So what is your perception of Japanese students, as far based on your experience? Are they different from the Americans or Nisei, people like you? What strikes you most when you deal with your own fellow countrymen, racially speaking, not politically or culturally? Perhaps maybe
educationally, they're a lot sharper. Maybe, I don't know if that's the group of students who come over, maybe. But they're more committed. Well, they've come a long way too. They're really committed. We had a lady who had just been married and had been married maybe 2 months or something like that, and came over to spend 2 years, to study at Indiana University. They're just
more studious.
Yes, I think so. And in spite of the language barrier, they were better students all the way around, just brilliant people. So
you enjoy the relationship?
Oh, yes. You see, the real interesting thing is, of course, as I said, my father was a farmer. And so I had grown up all of my younger days without knowing more than half a dozen Japanese people, without ever knowing anybody. And then, of course, in seminary, there were a few Japanese students in seminary, but these were people from Japan.
I see.
And so it's only after I'd gotten out of seminary a few years that I'd really gotten in touch with Japanese people. So really, I think more Anglo than I do any other way, because this is the whole culture in which I was, the only Japanese culture I had is within my own home.
So which seminary are you talking about? Drew?
I went to Drew, yes.
So the at home, your folks spoke Japanese?
Yes, yes. They spoke English well enough so that we could communicate either in a mixture of Japanese and English.
Any strong influence you think you received from your parents?
Sure.
What kind of things?
Yeah. So-called
the Japanese-ness,
yes.
Even though you are.
Yes, I think so. First of all, I am the number one son, I have an older sister, but I'm the oldest son. And my parents never let me forget this.
Chonan, huh?
And so...
Chonan, Japanese.
Yes.
First son.
So my job was basically to stay out of trouble. My younger brother used to, get in fights at school and things like that, but I wasn't ever to do that. I was to stay out of trouble and study. Because I think my parents felt that the one place where we could compete evenly was in the classroom. And so, though we lived on a farm, I guess I was the only kid in school who didn't have definite chores to do when he got home. My job was to get my study. And I didn't dare go out in the field until I had my studies, first of all. If I didn't bring home a book, my mother and father thought it was a crime that teachers weren't giving us enough work or something.
Typical kyoyukumama, what do you call it? Education.
Right. So education was pounded in us. For instance, my mother and father would never buy us a used book. Every book we ever bought or had was new, though it cost us a lot of money, and we didn't really have a lot of money. But it was important to them that we had new books. We didn't get one that somebody else has already used.
So you had a big sisters, yourself and a younger brother, right. Three children. That's very interesting. When you were little, at school, any problem you had as a kid? Since you are so different, so you are the only one.
Yes, I can remember a few incidents. And, and one of the things I think you need to understand is that I started school when I was 5 years old, okay? When I was small, my parents would not teach me English because somebody had told them that if they taught me English, I'd always speak with an accent. Mm-hmm. You know, and that generation of Japanese wanted their children to be American, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they wouldn't, they didn't, so when I started first grade, my father says that I didn't speak any English. Mm-hmm. And the reason I got out early is because he thought I would repeat first grade because I didn't know English, but I somehow or other I passed and I kept going all the way through. So I graduated when I was 16 from high school. But I don't know if they were, you know, real bits of discrimination or whether I perceived them to be such, but when I was small there were several times that, oh, I do remember one though very well. When I was in about the third grade, I think, we used to walk home from school. There were my sister and I and about in the corner, five of us lived around the corner from school, about 3 mile walk from where we lived. We were the furthest one. Well, in this first short stretch, we were all walking, and one of the fellows going to this grade school was older, he was 16 already, and was driving a car. And I remember that they picked all of us up, and then he didn't go very far until he stopped and said that, you know, he didn't want my sister and I to be riding there, so he made us get out, so we got out. And
it was during the war.
Oh no, way before the war. That was
1930s.
I was about 1930. This would be about 1930. Right. Right. During the war, we lived in southern Illinois, down close to Carroll, Illinois. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have to. We didn't go to the camp at all. Mm-hmm. The FBI. Two fellows from the FBI office, which was about 40 miles north of us, used to come down every other week. They came in on Wednesday every other week to visit us. And we got to be very good friends. They were very nice people and got to be good friends. In fact, my mother used to bake pies and have coffee and everything for them. And they said they really came not because they worried so much about us, but because all the people around were calling and they wanted to all, you know, people would be satisfied that somebody was watching us. Mm-hmm. So they used to come. There were several incidents during the war, you know. Once I was asked to leave a restaurant.
Refused the service.
Yes, And I think three different times I was threatened out on the street. Mm-hmm. Once somebody took the motor off of my car, you know, I couldn't start my car.
So that kind of incident didn't change your basic personality. You usually
I don't think so.
You know,
I don't think so.
Traumatic experience
I think one of the things I don't say I think I know that one of the things that really helped was that we had started being active in a little tiny what was then a Methodist church down in the town of Olive Branch, Illinois. And
so when did you become a Christian? Your parents are Christian?
No, my parents are not Christian at all.
Uh-huh. No. So when did you become Christian?
My dad always took us to Sunday school. You know, though he was a Buddhist background, he said there's only one God anyway, so he would take us to Sunday school. So as long as I can remember, from North Judson on, we had gone to Sunday school. Different denominations. In North Judson, it was Methodist, and Lowell, it was Presbyterian, and then for years I went to the old Evangelical church before it was Evangelical United Brethren. Mm-hmm. But I think...
So you have all the easy, the Sunday school experience when you're young. Huh?
Yes, though I don't think I really became a Christian until during the war years. I think there the youth fellowship of the middle church really supported us. As kids, my father and mother never did go out much. They stayed pretty close to home all the time. Mm-hmm. I can't remember them ever going to Sunday school with us. You know? Mm-hmm. My mother, I know, didn't, because she just never went out early.
Mm-hmm. You mean to say that they didn't have any social life at all?
in northern Illinois they did, because the Japanese community from Chicago used to come out once in a while, or a few of them that mm-hmm. they knew used to come out. Mm-hmm. But in southern Illinois, when we were in southern Illinois, there were
practically nobody.
Yeah, the only Japanese family around us was a photographer in Cairo, and they didn't know him at all. They socialized some with the people in this little farm community, but very limited. We really lived in southern Illinois. We lived between the white town and the black town, you know, because they were separated in southern Illinois. And because the black community used to come over to work, you know, either thinning out cotton, picking cotton, or strawberries, or things that we raised. My mother got friendly with some of the black families in that area. But even then, just maybe one or two, and that's all.
So what made you to become a Christian? Can you tell me some stories about your convergence? That was in the early 20s, is that right? In terms of age.
My age, yes.
Yeah.
Early 20s, that's right. Because I started college when I was 24. Well, you know, I think the biggest thing that becoming a Christian, the youth group there at the church just supported us and stayed with us, and no matter what happened outside, they, you know, really encouraged us and things like that. So I became a Christian, I think, in that sense, mm-hmm. at that time.
The people are nice to you, so
yes, uh-huh.
it moved you.
Yes, uh-huh, uh-huh. right. Mm-hmm. And Southern Illinois is a very conservative conference, theologically, mm-hmm. and had revivals, camp meetings, and things of that sort. And all of those things, I think, but it's mostly the kids in the group. I think the thing that moved me to the ministry was just as the war started. It's a little bit of a story, but I played baseball, and I pitched some on baseball. And the year before the war started, in 1940, we didn't have a team in the little town I was in, but the town next to it had a team. And because they were playing somebody and didn't have a pitcher, they asked me to come over and pitch. My brother's really a better ball player. He could play with the outfield. So I pitched and won a key game for them, and did very well, really. And right after that 4th of July game that they were playing, one of the men of the team was so impressed that he took my brother and I out to eat and everything else. Then the war came, and of course most of the people disappeared, and so we made a team, a pickup team, between some of the people from our town and the town that I played with the year before. And one day when we were going out to play, the same guy tried to dissuade his younger son from playing on the team with us, saying that he had a brother in service, things of that sort, and tried to dissuade his son, but his son would play with us anyway. And I think that was the beginning of just thinking about the whole matter of what the problems were, what little bit I could do, and things of that sort, and moved me in the direction of ministry. Okay. At the same time, the conference youth director at that time had formed a sort of a deputation team of youth from our conference who would fill in for ministers who were on vacation during the summertime. There were about, I don't know, 8 or 10 of us on the team. And he asked me to be a part of it. And at first I thought, no, I didn't want to be a part of it. One of the reasons was because I lived so far south. Carol's way down on the point. But he insisted, and so I went on that team, and I think as I went on that team, it convinced me more and more that ministry was the area that I had to go to, so I went into the ministry.
This is rather unusual for second generation Japanese to go into the ministry, or it was at the time rather popular profession. So there wasn't any choice for you, any other meaningful profession you could pursue?
No, I really don't know. I didn't know any any Asians in ministry at that time. Didn't know a soul. I knew some by correspondence, like I knew people at all.
By correspondence.
Yes, right. It's just that somebody, a lot of the ministers from Southern Illinois went to Asbury. Mm-hmm. And so they told me that they were there, and just because it was during the war years, I thought, well, I'll just write to them and have some sort of a correspondence. But didn't meet them until, oh gosh, years and years and years later. So I didn't really know any Asians in ministry at all.
Actually, you just decided.
Yes, right.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Though I had many Caucasian friends, you know, who were going in the ministry. Uh-huh. And so there were quite a few of us who started at McKendree College together. Uh-huh. But these were all Caucasian friends that I had.
Okay, so much for your personal stories. Let me talk. Uh-huh. Let's talk about your public experience. Uh-huh. So you retire as a DS, mm-hmm. So you are one of the successful persons in the ministries, because everybody want to be a DS, yet not many people make to that uh-huh. level. So.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so how you woke up to that top ladder of a profession? So.
You know, I really don't know, because when I became a district superintendent, salary-wise, I was lower than my peers.
Why so?
I think primarily because I was a bachelor. You know, maybe some because I was Asian, but I think primarily because I was single.
But there is the schedules of the salary for the ministers based on my years and experience as well as education.
Well, anyway, it could be both, I'm not sure. But anyway, I really was behind my peers when I became a district superintendent. I think some of the district superintendents told me afterwards that they had asked the bishop several years prior to the time I came on to consider me. Because I think even though I was below my peers in salary, I think I was well respected in the conference. But the bishop at that time said that he felt that the district superintendents ought to be married people, you know, so mm-hmm. spouses could help in the process. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't appoint me. And finally, when Bishop Armstrong became the bishop here, mm-hmm. He forgot all of that and just appointed me. In fact, two of us
forgot about what?
Where I was and the salary level, the fact that I was single, In fact, he appointed two district superintendents at the same time, and both of us, or neither one of us, were up close to any place near district superintendent in salary at all. Mm-hmm. So I think when I came on, the superintendent's salary is something like 36,000, I'm not sure, or something mm-hmm. like that. And I was getting, I think, 18,600. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a
that's the
big jump. Big jump. Mm-hmm.
So why the Bishop Armstrong appointed you to the district superintendent?
I have no idea. I really don't know.
At least you can speculate.
Well, I think Bishop Armstrong was aware of ethnic representation, for one thing. We did have one black superintendent, Charles Hutchinson, who was on the superintendency then, and I think he was aware of that. I think also this was his first year on as a bishop, and he had circulated a letter to all the pastors in the conference asking for their suggestions. And as I understand it, the two of us were the highest on the list. But he said himself, he took for the first year, he took the highest people that the conference had suggested, or all the clergy in the conference had suggested. And Charles Armstrong and I were the highest people on the list.
the Bishop Armstrong, the one who defrocked himself.
Yes, yes.
That one you're referring to.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes, that's right.
Okay. That's a conference recommendation. In other words, the nomination of the district superintendent by the local pastors. Is that how you work?
Well, no, he doesn't work always that way. Some of the bishops always do this, you know, or once in a while do this. They give us a suggestion. They don't say how the people listed people or anything like that, just to get some feeling of what the ministers think. But I guess from what I gather, I was pretty high on the list anyway.
So what is some of your assets that you think the people recommend you so highly?
I think
dedication.
I think dedication is one. Mm-hmm. And I think another thing is that I'm a people-centered person. I'm not a great, I don't think I'm a great administrator. Mm-hmm. Other people think that I do it fairly well, but I don't think I'm a great administrator. But I think I make up for administration by being concerned with people and what's happening. And so without really knowing how it happens, I think I take care of conflict fairly well. But I don't do it by analysis so much as I do by caring, I think. And working from that angle, I think that's really my strongest point. I'm
concerned about the people.
Yes, yes.
Rather than meticulous administration.
That's right. I'm not a great as a district superintendent. I don't think I pushed program real hard. You know, I'm not a great stickler on ministers attending district meetings. They do if they want, and I encourage them to do it, but we don't have any rules, didn't have any rules about attending. Churches buy into programs they want to buy into and leave out the programs they don't want to do, you know, this sort of thing. So maybe it's not a good style for a superintendent.
There is a lot of competition among the clergy to be a district superintendent.
Yes, there's
a rather keen competition,
yes.
If I understand correctly.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Any side reaction, any side effect after you become the first Asian American district superintendent in this country?
Well, you know, I'd have to say that there were good times, and there are very bad times. If I were young enough and still in ministry and were eligible to be a superintendent again, I would never do it again. You know, I've done it once. I'm happy to have done it once.
That's interesting. Why you don't want to be a district superintendent again?
To me, it's just too much pressure in it, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'm not great. I resolve conflict well, but I don't handle conflict well within myself. I'm not the kind who could go out and talk to somebody and then forget it, you know, overnight. I live with it all the time, and it just wears me down, you know.
So what wears you down most? What kind of problem you're talking about?
I'm talking about the conflict between pastor and church and pastor parish committees and this sort of thing, which is a basic conflict that, you know, you work with. The charge conferences are wearing physically because, you know, it's go, 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 go. But I love charge conferences because it's a time when you get to meet people that you may never get to meet any other time during the year.
Church has no problem. You are happy to meet them.
Oh, yes. Love that.
But with a problem.
Yes, uh-huh, yeah.
I see.
It's not that I ran away from conflict, because I don't think I did. You know, I don't think I do run away from conflict. But it wears into it.
How often the that kind of problem, maybe in terms of percentage, conflict between pastor and the congregation.
Oh,
it's quite a few.
Yes, I think there are quite a few.
You would say 20%, 30%?
Of my time?
Yes.
Oh, I would say...
50%.
No, I don't think maybe 50%. But I would say it'll run 20 or 25% anyway. Mm-hmm.
Then you have to move the pastors to other places.
Well, sometimes, you know, and that's the difficult thing, because I did move the pastor all the time. Mm-hmm. Most of the time I try to keep the pastor there. I don't think it helps much, helps the pastor or the congregation much to move them at the first sign of, you know, conflict between them. So
what is your philosophy of keeping the pastors, at least how many years, as a DS, we like to keep the pastors in one church?
Oh, this is hard to say, because it differs with churches.
Mm-hmm. But you said that you don't want to move the people frequently. You rather encourage them to stay,
yes,
if possible.
Yes. I think, you know, I think that any conflict between pastor and church is a difficulty of both groups. It's not just one group or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And moving the pastor when something just goes wrong doesn't teach the pastor to work out certain things. And the church gets the impression that if something happens they don't like, they can jump on the district superintendent, and the district superintendent's going to solve it by giving them another pastor. Mm-hmm. And the chances are that the next pastor who goes in is going to hit the same problem again. Mm-hmm. So I think it's imperative, if at all possible, sometimes it's really not possible, but if at all possible, that at least to try to work it so there's a span of time.
Mm-hmm.
That even if you have to move the pastor, you don't move him here, but you might move him up here someplace after the span of time where they've had a chance to discuss and do things.
You think you're successful in, you know, the reconciling of both parties?
Some of them.
Some of them.
No, you don't win them all.
I see. How successful? Maybe 50-50 or more than 50?
Oh, I think I would think more than 50-50. Yes.
So you have your way, huh?
I think.
Was it 70-30, something like that?
Well, I think at least that. Yes. At least that.
Uh-huh. So after a while, then you will move anyway.
Yes. Uh-huh.
What is the average period of time one pastor can serve in your conference while you are...
Oh gosh, you know...
It varies, of course.
Yeah, and we've moved a lot of people with short tenures lately because of a lot of retirements and everything else that has forced, you know, movements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would say that we probably would average, I don't know, average,
mm-hmm.
4 or 5 years maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, uh-huh. We have some that have been there 20 years, you know, but it's unusual.
Yeah, this is one of a fascinating subject, you know, the Methodist Church always move pastors from time to time.
Yes, uh-huh.
You know, lots of people don't understand.
Yeah.
Do you think, you are once in the position of a DS, so you know the stories of which you don't. Do you think it's a good system? For the sake
well,
of the
yes, I think it's a good system. I think it's a good
you
system.
You really do, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And several
State
reasons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, several reasons, I think. Just looking at my experience in just those 6 years, I think the cabinet with a bishop does a better job of assigning pastors than the local church has in selecting a pastor. I think the local church, though it feels and knows what it wants, has a narrower vision of what the total congregation is than the cabinet has. I really believe this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if left, at sometimes, I should qualify that to say, sometimes even the cabinet puts in somebody they know is not the best fit because of the fact of guaranteed appointment and everything else. And the best move isn't made. But I think for the most part,
I think the cabinet does a real good job of placing people. Better, I think, than the local church can do.
Mm-hmm.
And do it more quickly than the local church can do.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but the one criticism is the church may not get settled because
somebody moves.
Yeah, somebody
yes,
moves.
Yes.
So the pastor tend to think, well, I'm going to be here a few years
yes.
anyway. So don't do anything, just stay there until the next move.
That is an argument, I think a valid argument.
Okay.
I think it's a valid argument. We usually, very seldom do we move somebody who doesn't want to move. You know, they would stay, however, some of those people would stay if we hadn't asked them to move. But, of course, the whole matter of operability comes into the picture. And sometimes the desires of the church and the pastor are not the same, and we work for both ends. But that is a valid argument about
So you heard me a criticism before.
Oh, sure, and I think it's true. It's true. But I don't know the real solution. That's the problem. Otherwise, you know, if you're talking about somebody keeping up with their peers, then you get caught in that.
Can you describe the process of making decisions and moving one pastor from one church to another? How a decision is made? We only know the result.
Yes, You know, in the cabinet, when an opening occurs in a church, then every cabinet member looks at his or her own district thinks about it and says, well, after the pastor, district superintendent of that church gets a profile from a local church and then presents it to the cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Then every district superintendent presents a name or names from his or her own district who they think would fit there. After that is done, then the district superintendent of where the church is has looked over the whole list and decides, is there anybody else, you know, in the district, any place, who he or she thinks would fit that church well. And all of these names are listed. The salary, along with the salary and everything else, are listed on a board. And then becomes a long process of discussion. After the district superintendent looks through the list, if he knows somebody and says, no, I really don't think that person fits the profile of that church well, then that person gets scratched off, or the local district superintendent might scratch the person off. So eventually you come up with probably 3 or 4 or 5 names, you know, for that local church. Then comes a period of discussion that we all enter in, what we think about these people, what we know, because none of us knows everybody in the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all share in what we know about the person, we share in what we know about that particular church, and come to some sort of consensus about who we would suggest that we would send to that particular church.
Mm-hmm. Then Bishop finalized?
Yes, the bishop. There are 10 district superintendents, but the bishop has 11 votes, you know. Yes, the bishop is the finally decided. Though the bishop does not very often go against the decision of the district superintendents.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while he will, you know, especially our bishop, who we have now, Bishop Hodat, because he had been in Indiana and served in the South Indiana Conference for so many years before he became a bishop, so he knows a lot of these churches intimately.
So everybody likes to go to the bigger and the better church from a small church.
Sure.
How do you resolve this kind of a problem? Nobody want to go to a small rural church. Is that true? How it works?
Yeah, that's why the small rural church really gets the short end as far as moves are concerned. Because most of the people who are just coming out of seminary go to rural churches. And there are maybe a handful of people who want to serve, who really want to serve rural churches.
Is there any volunteer who really like to serve in the rural church?
Yes, yes.
A very handful minority.
Yes, about a handful, that's right.
So always there is a vacancy in the rural church.
Right.
How do you resolve the this type of difficulty? So.
Well, any openings we have at the end of the year is always on the bottom end of the scale. Mm-hmm. And we fill these, if we don't have anybody there, we fill these by looking at people who have asked to come into our conference. Mm-hmm. And most of these people are not United Methodists, you know, mm-hmm. from some other denomination. And anybody who comes into our church from another denomination, we say automatically, if you want to come in, we have to have an opening, and then you have to realize that you're going to come in mm-hmm. at the bottom end of the mm-hmm. totem pole. We hardly ever, I can't think of a time where did we transfer somebody from another denomination into any of our better churches. We used to do this all the time. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right, so that's the one alternative solution.
Yes. Yes. You know, some people have suggested this, that maybe we ought to do this so that the people in the middle and the lower middle part of the salary scale won't move after 2 years or 3 years. Mm-hmm. Our greatest movement is in the 24,000 bracket. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people have moved after just 2 or 3 years. And they said, well, if we bring somebody in from outside mm-hmm. and put them in a $30,000 church, then those people wouldn't have to move quite so quickly. Mm-hmm. Well, it would make the clergy pretty unhappy, I think, to do that, but that is one option.
So everybody like to move to a bigger yes. church. Yes. Yeah, that's
the church is as capitalistic as
any after appointment, the district superintendent gets a lot of complaints from local pastors.
Oh, most of those are ironed out before conference, and for the most part, I think we work those out pretty well. Yes, working on pretty well. We talk pretty closely in our conference with pastor parish committees. We don't arbitrarily just send somebody, but we try to work it out and talk with people, and though the church may be not as happy as they might be, they understand when we finish that they agree with us that, you know, they'll give it the best shot they know how. And
okay, the comment on the church bureaucracy, so Methodist church top high and then bottom weak, mm-hmm. the discriticism, what do you think of it? For example, Methodist minister too secure, mm-hmm. just like a university professor, they have a tenure, all they are doing is buying out the time, right. buying the time. Right. Well, what do you think of it? Maybe since you are retired, so mm-hmm. you are free to make a comment.
I think there's a lot of question now about the guaranteed appointment, you know, mm-hmm. and it comes up the general conference every year, and it'll come up again this year, this next year general conference about the whole matter of guaranteed appointment. Mm-hmm. I think the clergy have to look at this very seriously, because the guaranteed appointment was a trade-off with itinerancy. Mm-hmm. And it's getting now so that itinerancy is really not itinerancy. It's a very limited itinerancy. And so I think the clergy are going to have to look at it very closely, that if they want guaranteed appointment, they're going to have to go back to itinerancy. Mm-hmm. And if they don't want to have itinerancy, then I think the guaranteed appointment thing is going to go. Because even now, we still do have guaranteed appointment, but I think groups are working very, very hard on finding ways of exiting pastors, and we have exited a few in this conference.
And getting out the profession.
Yes.
No, you see.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think it's coming. Mm-hmm. I think the lay people, especially, are rising up in arms about incompetent pastors and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. Well, again, somebody's going to have to define what incompetency mm-hmm. is.
Mm-hmm. And, how many years of probation period? So itinerancy, so you are talking about. How many years are you thinking of?
Oh, probationary?
Yes, in university we have a 5 to 7 years.
Yes, uh-huh, right. It's only 2 years, in the church.
That's too short.
Too short a time, yes, right. But I think our feeling in the United Methodist Church is that once they reach probationary, you know, they almost think that full membership is automatic.
Mm-hmm.
While we have delayed several people, our board of ministry has delayed several people, in fact has terminated at least one or two people during that probationary period. So, you know, I think the church is getting more realistic about a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm. So you think it will be changed eventually?
I think eventually some kind of thing will change, yes. Right. I don't see any alternative.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that good change, I guess.
Yes.
For so many years people are talking about
that. Yes.
Even university, we have a 5 to 7 years probation.
Well, you know, one of the real difficult things about the United Methodist Church is that if you exit somebody, it has to be voted by their peers in executive session. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to get all of your peers to vote to say one of their body should not be serving in the ministry.
Yeah.
And
kind of paternalism.
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah. And ministers tend not to be realistic about some things anyway.
Yeah, sure.
So
that's the major problem.
Right?
Uh-huh. Well, what do you think about the future of the church?
Well, I think the church is doing well. I think it's doing
well,
better. I really do.
Pessimistic report that we are losing our membership.
Yes, we're losing some members, all right. Mm-hmm. But our attendance is up, you know, worship
mm-hmm.
attendance is up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the church, I'm optimistic about the church
mm-hmm.
coming along. I really am.
Yes.
I think it shows more spirit now than it has in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Methodist Church has been good to you?
Yes, yeah, it has been good to me. I have no quarrels with the United Methodist Church. It's been good to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, anything you'd like to say for future pastors?
I don't know. I think, basically, we have to be at a place where we really care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe, or sometimes I think, some of the people coming out now really are not as caring. People, you could get, you can have a lot of shortcomings if the people in your congregation think you really care about them.
Mm-hmm.
You could preach almost anything, or you can preach the social gospel from here to eternity
mm-hmm.
if people think you really care about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is really the key.
Dedication.
Yes,
the caring.
Yes. And that's what a pastor is. A pastor
mm-hmm.
is a caring, is a carer of people. So,
that's the key to the ministry.
Yes, I think so. And if you don't care, the people think you don't care, you know, you can have every talent you want to have. When I was a superintendent, for instance, I had very few complaints about a person's preaching, though
mm-hmm.
I knew that some of those people didn't preach well.
Mm-hmm.
Very few complaints about their preaching. But I had a lot of complaints about people who came and said, their pastor doesn't seem to listen to me,
mm-hmm.
and you could talk, he says, you could talk yourself blue in the face, but he just goes on his own way,
mm-hmm.
This sort of thing. This is the biggest complaint I had.
So actually, based on your experience, love and care is essential
to
successful ministry.
So. I think it's a key. I think it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment, because I often hear the poor sermon
mm-hmm.
make the congregation turn off.
Yeah.
But very little criticism about
that's
that.
That's right. Well, I don't say that. I think pastors should improve in their preaching. You know, there's no
mm-hmm.
point about it. About that, but I say, as far as complaints are concerned, I would say I have many more complaints about a person's relationship than his skills. So,
well, last personal question: How come you didn't get married?